is because this wasn't, and this would ask if I could talk with them about their experiences, there was so much hesitancy. Mm-hmm. And then when I mentioned that I was an adoptee as well, as one woman put it, well, then you know what it's like. And there was such intensity in her voice that I did know what it was like, mm-hmm. but I knew what my experience was like, not hers. And so as I published my research findings, that just became research, right? It becomes kind of faithless. And so what I really wanted to do then is I wanted to put a face to that story. And how do I do that? I could have taken several of the stories that had been given to me, and I had attained approval to do that. But the problem is that there is so much pain in these stories. Mm-hmm. They aren't mine to tell. They belong to their owners to tell those stories. And so then I really wanted to do a documentary. And, you know, this was in 2007, 2008. But I couldn't really convey to people why this was important. So that kind of fell by the wayside. And I didn't want to fictionalize it. I didn't want to make it a fictional piece. Sure. Because I didn't want anybody to say, oh, well, she really dramatized this part because this isn't how it would really happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it becomes, well, if I want to tell the story, then it's probably going to have to be my story to tell. And it took me a couple of years of really thinking about how badly did I want to do that, because I'm definitely speaking truth to power,
mm-hmm.
and you can get a lot of pushback from that.
Yes. Yeah, one thing that blew me away, having been an anthropologist with a psych minor and, you know, all the fields you've mentioned, I knew about the adoption out, but your statistic that it was nearly a third of the children in that community were outsourced either through the foster system or adoption to white families.
Well, let me clarify.
Okay.
It was actually a third of American Indian children.
Okay.
Not just from my reservation, but a third of American Indian children had been placed with non-Native families.
Right. That's just wrenching. Yeah, literally. And that is the beginning of Indian Child Welfare Act?
Well, what had happened is this was by 1974
okay.
that they really began to understand it. And I was talking with a woman from my reservation, this was several years ago, and I had asked her, well, how many of us were placed out? And she said, we don't really know. And I said, well, you had records. And she said, well, we didn't really keep records for the first two or three years. We didn't keep records until we realized how fast mm-hmm. our children were being placed.
Wow.
And so, and I think that's, you know, that was part of the real underbelly of a lot of this stuff, is that it really kind of wasn't on the up and up. And so, so yeah, that's a really important statistic to keep in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is all of a sudden people start realizing how many kids are being placed, and there is a move to create legislation to stop the wholesale removal of Indian kids from reservation mm-hmm. families, and that became the Indian Child Welfare Act of 1978.
Yes, that. Which was so necessary, and I see it being challenged now frequently, and I find that disturbing.
It is, and the people that are bringing that about are pretty. They're heavily funded by very conservative think tanks,
mm-hmm.
which means that they're really trying to undo the Indian Child Welfare Act, and they've got a lot of money to do it. And the money is being directed, you know, as coming from, you know, the Koch brothers as well as other types of money.
So sick of the Koch brothers.
Right. And so they've got a lot of money to throw at it. Mm-hmm. And it's like a lot of ideas that are bandied about right now is that there's enough reality placed in there to where if you don't look very much below the surface, nothing sounds horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And so with the, so for instance, the Goldwater Institute that is behind the legislation to undo the Indian Child Welfare Act, they say it's based on race. And it is. You know, you have to say how much of a blood quantum a child has and how can they become a member. And if they are a member, then they fall under the Indian Child Welfare Act. And so what they say is, they said, well, this is based on race, so therefore it's unconstitutional.
Yeah, but that was my people's idea, not yours.
That's exactly it. We didn't ethnically take ourselves
mm-hmm.
aside and say we are going to racially be known as American Indians, and we want all of these protections because of that. It's like, no, you are American Indians, and we're going to tell you what protections we want you to have. And as you've seen over the centuries, those protections have been undermined
mm-hmm.
time and time and time again with Indian removal and with the boarding schools and with termination and
yep.
relocation and eventually with American Indian child placement.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's gotten really, really ugly. And that's probably the biggest thing that I really want people to know is that it's not just that we're Indian. It's just that our kids are being disproportionately placed.
Mm-hmm.
And they're being disproportionately placed because we have been knocked out from our knees every single generation
mm-hmm.
with some sort of assimilation policy. It's been the active destruction of American Indian families.
Yes.
And I mean an active destruction.
Yes, and I've seen it. You know, it hasn't happened to me, but I've seen it. And now I'm also seeing the generation of kids born to people who were adopted out and who then moved back to the reservation. And that second generation has, you know, struggles as well.
Mm-hmm.
Different last names, different identities, raised maybe partly elsewhere or entirely elsewhere, and now they're back. So it just, you know, like the other assimilation processes, there's no undoing this.
Right, right. And the other piece is, as an anthropologist, you know that ethnic groups define themselves.
Mm-hmm.
We define ourselves, and we define the other. And ourselves are basically, you know, we have this and this and this and this, and if you're part of this ethnic group, these are the characteristics we are going to have.
Mm-hmm.
And if you belong to someone else, these are the characteristics they will have. And a lot of times, the characteristics we will have are like these really positive characteristics. And the characteristics they will have are a lot of times pretty negative characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that from group to group to group to group.
Yes.
Well, if you come from the outside into a group, you will have already been ascribed a lot of negative characteristics to begin with. And on top of it, you don't know the culture, and
mm-hmm.
you don't have a social network, and you don't have a community network, and you don't know the language, and you don't know anything, and you really have to hope that somebody steps in to say, this wasn't your fault,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to work with you.
Yes.
But I think a lot of times we are as
Yes.
But I think a lot of times we are, as American Indian people, we are so tenuously associated with that really deep, intense part of the identity that sometimes it's really difficult to invite somebody else in if we're worried about being accepted ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the assimilation programs have really worked up at us on so many levels.
Yeah. And I don't know what your thoughts on this are, but I think maybe you referenced your one brother talking about this, the trauma of being the ones left on the reservation and what was maybe not a healthy family at times, or the trauma of the mother who had children that she lost and was not able to reclaim, or the dad who didn't step up. When you come back, at least in my family, it brings up all that other trauma that maybe people haven't dealt with yet either.
Right, and a lot of times they don't deal with it because that's the norm.
Yeah.
That's not anything uncommon. And in fact, that's so common in reservation communities and in reservation families.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably, as I've gone out and I've done presentations to different groups, when I talk with primarily American Indian groups, a lot of people are surprised at how the dots are connected,
mm-hmm.
because they know about the boarding schools. They kind of know about termination and relocation,
mm-hmm.
but the boarding school, that has become the banner under which all of this stuff happened. It's like, oh, no, it's happened in a variety of ways,
mm-hmm.
and it's happened a lot, and pretty soon you can start listening to them say, well, you know, I had a cousin that was adopted, or
yep.
I had, and you start hearing that this has a, and I think that's the other piece that we need to be really, really honest with ourselves about, is there is not one person in the American Indian family or Indian community or Indian tribe or Indian nation that has not been affected by an assimilation program.
Yes. Yeah,
and every single one of us has.
Indeed, it's hard. And the one program you haven't mentioned, I think, is the sterilization that went on through the 1980s, as far as I can tell. Involuntary, generally, sterilization of women. And from what I can see with some of the populations I work with, also the men, there are some who suspiciously had no kids.
And that just absolutely boggles my mind.
Yeah.
There are so many beliefs built into that,
mm-hmm.
about them, right? Them in quotes, or
mm-hmm.
they in quotes. And it just,
yeah.
I think it really takes somebody who really wants to think about an issue. I mean, it's so easy to say, we're just going to look at this superficially. I don't have time. I've got,
mm-hmm.
you know, I've got a job and I've got to feed my family and I've got to do this and I've got to do that. And hey, here's this headline. And well, yeah, these kids, they don't know what they're doing,
mm-hmm.
and they're not going to be good parents anyway. And look what it's like up on the reservation, and
yep.
turn the page and they're off to something else. And so we need to really, I think, reach out and get people to think very strongly about what our history is and educate people
mm-hmm.
about our history, because it's not being done in schools.
No. And I taught Indian studies in a college, which was, of course, ridiculous since I'm a white chick, but whatever. And I had students get angry at me saying these things can't be true, white students, because they had never heard of it. So I'm like, you're just not being taught. They didn't realize there's ongoing genocide and, you know, we're not post-colonial, we are colonial. And they
right.
they were angry they hadn't heard as much as they were angry it was going on. So
right.
And
right.
then I see that in the reservation schools too. It's just not taught.
Right. And when you think about what are the reasons
mm-hmm.
it might not be taught? Well, the reasons are, what happens if we get ourselves some power?
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you what people are afraid of. Oh my God, what if they want their land back?
Yeah, that is actually in the St. Mary's, Idaho newspaper every week.
Yes, yes.
They might kick the white people out. We've been here for two generations.
Well, if you look at what's going on in Africa,
yes.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, Mozambique kicked out the Portuguese,
mm-hmm.
and you know, all these countries have really done a lot to remove that. But that's, I think when you do the things, when you are a group in power that have done the things that whites have done to American Indian tribes and to other ethnicities mm-hmm. as well, then there is a lot of guilt in there somewhere, and that's where that fear comes in.
Yes, and I think that's when we put our identity problem on you.
Right, right. And so we really need to educate, and I'm glad that you are doing that. And you know, if you are a white person doing that, at least you've got a conversation started. And that's probably, to me, the most important part of this.
Mm-hmm.
We have to start the conversation.
Yes. And I think your book will really help, and I hope it does result in a film or something else. And you know, you bring out a really fantastic point late in your book when you said at times you needed more parents, but you didn't need to be cut off from your whole parent, family, friends, and community. And you know, there are ways of providing parents to kids without removing them.
Right, right.
So that was a really good point.
Well, and I think we really, that's another big conversation that we really need to have is it explores that in-between place. I mean, all you have to do is look in the court system at custody battles.
Mm-hmm.
This child is either my kid or they're your kid. And we can't have our kids. Somebody needs to be in control. Mm-hmm. Somebody needs to be. And if you are going to look at something like open adoption, that is going to be far more than a couple of photos mm-hmm. and letters that may or may not be read. If you're going to look at contacts and if you're going to look at a relationship,
mm-hmm.
then we're really going to need to educate ourselves about the reality of that big space in between.
Mm-hmm.
And that big space, even though it seems really scary, is a very, very rich place
yes.
to explore.
And it can be done. I worked with Washington State on a child in need of services issue to take on my godson for a few years without cutting him off from his family. And it's just, you know, it's a guardianship placement with oversight to make sure they stay in touch with their family and get the therapy and services they need. And I'm like, why can't we do more of that?
Right.
It didn't replace anybody. It just added, you know, one thing that was missing. So.
And I think that's a really important piece also, is if you look at child placement throughout the world,
mm-hmm.
ours is not the norm.
Mm-hmm.
Our placement that really comes from, you know, Western ideology is not the norm. There's all kinds of people that do all kinds of
yes.
placement where the child is not entirely removed. And,
right.
and they know the reason that they're not living with their families. And
mm-hmm.
and there's not the blame, and there's not the shame, and there's not all these other things that get
And the secrecy
into.
Is so annoying.
Well, the secrecy all of a sudden becomes
yeah.
what we carry
mm-hmm.
as the child, we carry that secrecy because it is such a negative definition, because it's no definition.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much. Is there a final point or two you want to make?
I think I've made them as we need to explore attitudes of open adoption. We need to get the information out to the larger public about what truly happened to us. And we need to have a conversation among ourselves about what we look like
mm-hmm.
Having come back from really kind of the brink of extinction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were on our way out.
Yes.
And they were making good headway on that. And so what are we going to look like now?
Mm-hmm.
And I think all of those things are really important for people to think about.
Yes. Thank you. And thank you for your book. It seems to be part of a new blossoming of Indigenous authorship. In the last month, I've read your book, Tommy Oranges, and one of Erdrick's. And they've all been enlightening. So thank you again.
Oh, that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Jill. I really appreciated being on your program.
And thanks for calling in and struggling through.